All right, I want to tell you all about another Earwolf show that not only should you be listening to this show, but you are actively sabotaging your life and your potential for human joy if you aren't. It's the podcast that started it all, Comedy Bang Bang. This show is where host Scott Aukerman talks to interesting people. What do I mean by interesting people? I mean fucking famous homies like Nathan Fielder, Andy Richter, John Hamm. John the hamster, Ham, just all sorts of famous people dropping by, being funny. They got an open door policy, so you never know who's gonna stop by. So if you like laughing and like joy and experiencing the positive things that human beings are capable of experiencing, then you should listen to Comedy Bang Bang. And if you don't, then again, you're just boiling the life out of your heart. And why would you do that? Why would you do that to this beautiful gift that God gave you?
I come in with an envelope and I'd hand it to one of the professors. And I said, "Can you hold this envelope? I'll tell you when to open it." And when I would come to the first guy, and I would call on the one that looked like they were afraid of me, and I said, "Do you have a question?" And the first question, without fail, was, "If you were dating a guy, would you tell them before you went to bed with them?" And I would turn to the professor and I'd say, "Please open that envelope and read what I have written." Professor would open the envelope, open the paper, and look up with a smile and say, "If you were going to go to bed with a guy, would you tell him before you went to sleep with him?" And I'd look at the kid and I said, "That is the first question that every guy in this class asks me."
I'm Brandon Johnson. Welcome to Cracked Gets Personal, the show where we find people with insane life experiences and ask them all the questions you're too embarrassed to ask. This week, we're talking to three transgender women who transitioned back in an era before most people knew what the hell that even meant. With me, as always, is my co-host and head of Cracked's personal experience articles, Robert Evans.
Thanks, Brandon. Trans folks have better visibility today than they've probably ever had. There are famous transgender men and women, popular TV shows that deal with transgender issues, and, you know, things still aren't great, but they've gotten a lot better. One story that really illustrates this. A couple years ago, some guy posted a question on Quora asking, what was it like to transition back in the 70s or 80s before there were any trans people out in the open? And no one responded for like a year until Allison Washington, one of our sources for today, stepped up to the plate. She told a haunting story of what she called the trans dark ages, a time very few trans people are still alive to talk about. Our sources today are some of the only ones left.
My name is Duffy Duffy. I'm a transgender rights activist working at the heart of UK government.
My name is Allison Washington. I'm an author. I write mostly stories about my own rather strange life.
Corinne will reach his point, thank you.
So, trans kids today don't exactly have it easy, but at least they can type, "I feel more like a girl than a boy," into Google, and there will be thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of information on every conceivable trans topic, from, you know, binding your chest if you want to hide your breasts, to hormone replacement therapy, to the surgical aspects, like if that's what you're interested in. Like, nothing's hidden about that anymore, and if you feel like you're not the gender you were born as, you've got a lot of information on that. That wasn't the case back in the 1960s, the 70s, the 50s, and all of our sources are from that time period. So these people are all transgender women who went decades in a lot of cases without really knowing there was even a name for what they were.
If I'm honest, I didn't hear about the word transgender till about another 3 years later. There was a program on the television in 1979 in the UK called A Change of Sex. And the word that was used then was very much sex change or transsexual. I didn't really hear that word as, say, transsexual or sex change until I saw this program in 1979, which suddenly again was the lining up of all things that I was feeling. So from the way I'd seen in that picture back in 1976, and then in 1979 when that television program came on.
Oh, goodness. I did not hear the term transgender until June of 2016, because I was not living any longer as a trans person. I was involved with the trans community. Indeed, I didn't know the trans community existed. I retransitioned to life as a woman in 1989, and in 1990 I disappeared into the woodwork and have lived like any other woman since then.
So that's something that strikes me as weird right off the bat, is like having to deal with the fact that like you've got this thing about you that's different from everybody else in your life, and no way to get any information out of it. Like, it's got to be isolating just being different. Like, it's got to be isolating being like a gay kid today in like rural Alabama, but at least you can look up what it is to be gay on the internet and read that there's communities out there. Like, not even, like, what Allison says is really interesting, that she just kind of disappeared into the woodwork and didn't think about it as an identity. Like, it wasn't an option to have a transgender identity if you transitioned back in the 1980s. There just weren't that.
We're talking about a time period, 60s and 70s, where people are fighting about gender and race and class. So to be in a different sexual class and to have to educate people on that is an uphill battle.
Yeah.
That's the craziest. It's almost like you're trying to educate people about pasta, but first you got to explain what flour and water and oil are.
Like the ingredients of just the language to talk about it
right.
That exists. Yeah.
Much less trying to find the makeup that covers stubble.
Or figuring out like the proper way to tuck. Like there's guides to that now. Like you can find YouTube videos that'll teach you how to do like anything you might need to do now. And it wasn't an option back then. One of the things that's interesting to me about that is that all of our sources, Corrine, Allison, and Jackie, discovered they were transgender and like the concept that was a thing sort of simultaneously. Like it wasn't this awareness that existed and then realizing, oh, that's me. It was like learning both of those things at the same time.
Also, this idea that you have a secret that you don't think anybody else would have, so you would never even think to put together a community. Quite the opposite of D&D.
It's so lonely, too. Like, yeah. That's the thing that really seems so difficult about it, is that, like, you know that you're different from the get-go, but you just think that it's like you're the only person in the world.
Like a black Van Halen fan.
Yeah, exactly. Like a black Van Halen fan. Or no, I can't think of anything more isolating than that.
As far as understanding that there was a difference between myself and my other male-presenting peers, that started to present around age 6. Because I had nobody to compare it to, I was always disappointed that I wasn't considered one of the girls, didn't really understand what it was by age 6. We're talking about the year 1959. You know, these things just weren't noticed. Things were noticed later on, but at that time, no. And of course, there were no names to attach to a different feeling, just question marks coming out of the top of my head that I didn't really articulate very well. Just as a child would know something didn't feel quite right, but thought nothing of it at the time. By age 10, I was raiding my mother's closet. I got caught, but they attached no special significance to it. My father had asked me a question, which was, by age 10, I knew to be a very embarrassing question. He sat me down and asked me, "Do you want to be a girl?" My heart jumped into my throat. My father was an interesting mix of rigidity and compassion. Obviously, would never understand such a thing. And of course, you know, my heart jumped into my throat and I, no. However, that did not stop the feeling. It just meant I was so embarrassed by it. It started to push down of feelings and repression of things like that.
Like nowadays, that's like the best case scenario, right? Is that like a parent notices something's different about you and is like, hey, is it possible that like this is what's going on? And you have that support. But like back then, she had, you know, 1959. There was so little information out there that when that support was offered, she just immediately was like, no, I'm not weird. Please don't think I'm weird.
Yeah, because even a kid knows what's acceptable and what isn't. And you can say to him, I have your back on this, but he or she looks around and goes, you may have my back, but nobody else is going to have my back on this. There's this interesting part of it where you say, man, nobody knew about it. So perhaps that shielded you from some of the hate. Whereas a transgender teen today may say, well, we face more hatred because it is out in the open. Versus in 1959, you could kind of live a life of secrecy and it was all right, because there wasn't enough of an opinion formed against you, because it wasn't there.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you bring that up now, because that's going to come up a little bit later, that fact that there's aspects of today that are more dangerous because it's so much more widely known. Let's roll this clip from Jackie when she first realized she was transgender.
It was probably as a young 9-year-old kid. I was reading a magazine and there was a picture of a man in what I would describe as the Christy Keeley pose. It's the one where she sits there in the nude with the back of the chair up against her body, and she sat there in this pose, but this was a man doing it. But obviously, as a 9-year-old kid, I didn't realize it. This was what this pose was called. But this gentleman was very, very sad. He wasn't the most attractive of guys, but I then turned over to the next page. And the next page that proceeded was of exactly the same man, but this time he was ripping his skin off. What he was revealing was that of a beautiful lady with smooth skin, long hair, beautifully made up features. That was the wake-up call. I always felt I was different, but that was the wake-up call, that that's what I needed to be. And that's what I felt. I was always hiding something underneath myself. And that picture just spoke a million, million words to me.
Yeah, it's weird what sticks with you as a little kid.
It's interesting that in the female version of that photo, which is beautiful, they cover her body. She's still blotted out, but mainly her breasts are what they cover. But in the male version of that picture, he is allowed to be fully exposed, tits out.
Yeah, that is weird. You know, in Austin, that's why you can be topless if you're a man or a woman in the city of Austin, is because they like argued to the city courts, like, well, like, why are male nipples
right
so okay?
Right, right. We have so far to go in our own bodies when we know what we are and when we're confirmed on our own gender. So it's very difficult, this world that they have to navigate, because you question, like, what's obscene?
Yeah. At what point in transitioning does it become not okay to show your chest off?
Yeah. To be used to being a man walking around mowing your lawn with no shirt on to suddenly becoming a woman who, oh, I have to cover these now that I have these.
Yeah. Allison was a little bit unlike the rest of our sources in that she had a mom who kind of got right on board with the whole idea. And it didn't hurt that this was happening in Europe rather than the United States, where they're a little bit more open to everything.
Man, they put ketchup on everything.
And mayonnaise.
They'll put mayonnaise on it. They serve the French fries with peanut sauce. Yeah. So they can do anything.
It's fucking no rules over there.
It was my mother that allowed me to switch over to living as a girl. You know, 1961, she didn't really have a solid notion of what this was. She just knew that she had a son who wasn't a son at some level. And I think that her realization of that probably accumulated gradually, you know, because with young kids, you know, it's not especially highly gendered. But by age 7, it was a really big issue. And she accepted the fact that I would be living as a girl. She tried to enroll me, and, you know, in that day, you know, there's boys' uniforms and everything's all very strict and whatnot. Yeah, I would not put on. She bought me a uniform. She, like I said, she didn't have a sense of this the way people do now, you know, as far as transgender being a thing and trans kids being a thing. She just was trying to sort of wing it with a weird situation, I should think. But I refused. I would not put on the boys' uniform. So she tried sending me to school out of uniform. You know, I got sent home, and there was a big to-do about that. And then I refused to use the boys' washroom or wear the uniform or do any of this. And, you know, by the way, I had blonde hair about halfway down my back at this time because she had never cut my hair at my request. I didn't want my hair cut. So, yeah, so, you know, you can imagine in 19, what would that be? That would be like 1964, how I looked, you know, showing up at school. That lasted, I don't know. I don't know exactly, but maybe a week. and yeah, she pulled me back out.
Yeah, so that's like trying to deal with that bathroom issue before that was even like a political issue, like when you're just the only person who's ever brought this problem up.
They're trying to deal with the bathroom issue in a North Carolina sense, even before black people and white people are allowed to use the same bathrooms. So you can imagine that the gender issue is crazy.
Yeah.
It's untouched at that point. I'm shocked by how brave you are to lay the groundwork for the future of this movement and be so brand new at it all. But it's so brave. Because you get in trouble. You get picked on in school for the shirt that you wear.
Yeah.
You could have shoes that are like not name brand and that'll make you drop out. But here's somebody thinking about gender in a way like that.
Still. Yeah, the chutzpah it takes. Like when I was a little kid, I liked to wear vests, and I wore a vest to public school one day, and I got made fun of. And never again. Not ever again in my life did I wear a fucking rabbit? Vest.
You were a cartoon rabbit.
This is exactly why I stopped wearing vests, Brandon.
You're like a Richard Scarry driver. and yeah. cars, and cars, planes, and trains.
That's what everybody compared me to, is Richard fucking Scarry.
Young Frasier. I also like to smoke a pipe in you know, first grade. So, yeah, I got ridiculed for being a professor as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the point for me is, like, anytime I was doing something that everybody said was weird, I fucking stopped doing it because yeah. I didn't, like, that was terrifying. To not have the idea that, like, oh, I'm transgender and so I have this right, but just be like, I'm the only person in the world who was born as a boy and doesn't feel like a boy and wants to live as a woman as, like, a 7-year-old and stick to that. Despite the mockery and the hacksaw, like, that's like, yeah, chutzpah.
By the time we moved to Norway, I was, 12 years old? You know, which is an age at which, you know, she kind of felt like I really needed to be in school at that point. And so she did enroll me in school in Norway. And the thing there weren't any uniforms, and this is by now, this is like 1969, I think. So, you know, at that point, girls wore jeans and, you know, and there were no school uniforms like that. So when I show up at school wearing jeans, I just kind of looked like the other girls. Oh, and by the way, I should mention that my given name was a made-up name, a name that she had made up that sounded feminine. But in any case, my name passed as female. So, you know, when I was there, yeah, it never really came up.
I couldn't get my parents to give me a drum set. This woman took her kid all the way to Norway so that there was a chance that she could live normally.
Yeah, yeah, that's some quality momming. I don't know how much of her mom's decision was just that, like, the schools that she'd been going to weren't accepting and Norway might be better, but it sure seems like she had a lot of commitment to, like, giving her kid a chance to, like, be yourself, which is pretty revolutionary. So Norway's awesomeness was not the global norm. A few hundred thousand, I don't know how many miles away Scotland is from Norway. But over in rural Scotland, Jackie had to just sort of shove her feelings down as much as possible. She moved to London when she was 15 and transitioned, not the surgical kind, but the kind Allison did, where you just start dressing and living as a woman. And she got to experience that for about a year before her mom got sick. She had to move back to rural Scotland and detransition. And she described the process of detransitioning as
hell. I think the only word I can use is absolute hell. To have come so far and recognizing who you are and then just having to suddenly switch back. I suppose it's a bit like doing a jigsaw and somebody knocking that jigsaw over.
That's like going home for the holidays and you have to cut back on your drinking because you're around your family. But imagine having to cut back on your gender for the entire town.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. How do you deal with, like, that whiplash in your head of, like, living as a young woman versus living as a young man, especially in, like, the 60s when there was even more of a gender divide pretty much across the world? Like, it's more than just reducing the amount of wild turkey you drink when everyone's watching. Like,
is it wild turkey for you?
You got to walk differently. Transitioning and being forced to detransition back in the 60s was not an uncommon experience. You know, there were some places in the world that were good at it, like Norway, and then there were some places in the world that were terrible, like the United States. Allison had to move to the United States in the late 60s after having lived as a woman in Norway for a while. She wound up essentially leaving her mom for a variety of reasons and having to go live with her dad, and he was not cool with having a daughter when he expected to find a son.
This man that I really didn't know picked me up at the airport, and I mean, if you can imagine, I've got strawberry blonde hair down my back, I sound as I do, and I don't know what the hell he thought about that. I mean, I really don't. I can't even imagine. If I recall correctly, at that time, women couldn't even get their own checking accounts, right?
Jesus, really?
I don't think that women could do their own banking until 1973. I think it was around then that the law got changed. In the States, I'm saying, yeah.
I know that I just finished doing some interviews with women who had underground abortions back during the,
exactly. 50s.
And they pointed out that you couldn't buy condoms if you were a woman.
Yeah, this kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. But this is even until the early 70s. They had to have their husband's name on it, right?
Jeez.
My father's quote-unquote son shows up looking like this and sounding like this. And he wasn't having it, was he?
You had to go back.
I mean, first of all, he tried to cut my hair, and I wasn't having that. I was able to prevent that. But yeah, he enrolled me in an American school, you know, gendered as male, but looking like a, you know, like the other girls. And I was expected to go to gym class. that was just unbelievable. I mean, I was in no way prepared for that. I mean, I'd just been ripped away from all my friends and a situation that was very nice with me and sent to hell.
I mean, the immediate question on my mind hearing that is, how did you survive hell?
Well, my father was harsh. You know, he basically tried to beat the girl out of me. And the thing is, you know, I didn't even know how to pass as a boy. And so I didn't. And then at school, I became a target of attack. You know, at one point, I found myself, you know, in the gym locker room, you know, I'd gotten written up for refusing to participate because I wouldn't change into gym clothes. And you know, and then they finally, you know, I got in so much trouble that, you know, I showed up with the gym clothes and I tried to sneak in, you know, and change before anybody got there. But, you know, the boys caught me at it. And they decided to see what I had between my legs, and they did so. It was brutal. It was fucking brutal.
Brandon, you got some levity for us here?
Yeah, I also would not change out of my gym clothes. Into my gym clothes. I flunked 2 years of gym because I was like, I got up every morning, I put on the dopest matching polo Ralph Lauren ensemble. And when it came to gym and they said, hey man, put on these shorts, I was like, but there's girls out there, bro. I'm trying to get laid out here in gym class. I'm not taking off these clothes. So I'm like, damn, think about that on a level of 100 times that. I was fighting to wear some garbage Ralph Lauren, and this dude was actually fighting to wear his real sexuality. And that's incredible.
It's amazing that anyone could make gym class sound worse than it was for me, but clearly it was vastly worse, which is shocking, because it's just the worst.
It's your first, I'm getting funky, I smell new scents. Mm-hmm. So to be going through all that puberty with all those hormones, and then to have to stand up for yourself for the unexplained is incredible. That's the thing that keeps coming across, is how hardcore you have to be to make this decision and then stand by it.
Yeah, where I'm fundamentally like, can't understand this, is like, I keep coming back to like, oh, well, it must have been, it would just be so much easier to hide this, to pretend that you're not different. But I get, it must not be easier. Like, they wouldn't do it if it was easier. So I can't imagine how hard it is. Like, that's the only way I can understand how hard it would be to pretend that you're not different, is because it was clearly easier for them to be a woman in a boy's gym bathroom.
Which is crazy, because you're at the top of the food chain. You're a white European male, and you are choosing to suddenly become basically an oppressed person. That's how you know it's not a choice. It's not something that they can live without, because who would suddenly turn themselves into a victim if they didn't really feel like that was who they were?
There's certainly nothing to gain other than, like, it's more mentally comfortable to be honest about who you are than to hide it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's some David Blaine times 3,000.
Yeah. It's interesting to me how much of these women's lives they had to live as men. Like, Jackie went on to join the Royal Air Force in the late 1980s, which meant she was living as literally as masculine a life as possible. Like, it doesn't, like, that's fucking Top Gun shit.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's the... that's the most stereotypical man thing you can do, is go Tom Cruise your way into a career. Like, fighter pilot in the 1980s. Like, the only way to be more masculine would be to be a member of Whitesnake. One thing that helped keep her sane in this incredibly masculine environment was wearing women's clothing. That was like the tiny outlet for that side of herself. And that's actually eventually what sank and destroyed her career.
Thankfully, the modern day military in the UK is more open to that aspect, but... as you say, back then, I mean, for me, joining the military was me doing something that what I thought I always wanted to do. I mean, I always wanted to fly, and that's what I went in for. I was an officer cadet. Well, what happened for me, I mean, I was going through my basic training, and on one occasion, we were out for a 30-mile run with the full backpack, webbing, all that around us. And as we got to the end of that run, we were... pushed hard and pushed over the assault course, and I fell, smashed my kneecap up, and I was taken to Cambridge Military Hospital and down in Aldershot. And during that time, when I was in the hospital, they had to clear out my cupboards, and during that time when they were clearing out my cupboards, they found the pantyhose, the female shoes. Now, I could have said that they belonged to a girlfriend, but the fact was that I didn't make much of a secret, because of my eyebrows were always shaped, my legs didn't have much hair on them. As I recovered, I was asked what actually was this, and I was put through a process where I was given a bit of a, a roasting about it, and eventually I just cracked and I had to say, I can't do this anymore. I can't hide who I am anymore. I have to be true to myself. And eventually I bought my way out of the RAF.
I like at the moment this person was able to say, I could have said it was a girl that, and I had a bunch of girl stuff and looked like a complete player, that still stepped up to the plate and was brave and was like, no, that's mine. What up?
Part of it's like this extreme situation, like you're hurt, you're going to the hospital, you're like delirious on painkillers. Like in a way that's got to be like your big nightmare when you're trying to hide this thing, that like anybody else finds this out, you're in the fucking Air Force. Like that's not something you, clearly was something she was trying to hide from everybody. But then to choose to double down on it.
If you are listening to this right now, be inspired to do something that brave today.
Yeah.
That's how crazy that is. And you're in the course of your day, you don't have to make these sort of decisions, but don't wait.
Even if it means not becoming a fighter pilot.
Right. And I'm sure a lot of listeners are on their way to becoming fighter pilots who are listening to this.
That's our demo for sure,
right.
is young fighter pilots. So Allison, at this point, just sort of assumed she was the only transgender person in the world. She didn't even have the word transgender to attach to it. Like, she just assumed she was weird and there was nobody else like her, and kind of lived her life that way in the 1980s. So she presented as a man, you know, she had to grow up as a man in her late high school career. And she didn't know that there was anyone else like her, that this was a thing. This mm-hmm. wasn't just something that only affected her, until a fateful trip to an abortion clinic in 1980.
A friend of mine got in the spot of trouble. She got pregnant and needed to have an abortion. And I went with her basically to hold her hand, you know, while she went through that, went to the abortion clinic. So, you know, while she's actually having the procedure, so I'm out in the waiting room sort of cooling my heels, looking at all the, you know, books and literature that they have there and everything. And there's this little thin booklet with a blue cover called The Uninvited Dilemma, a little horribly written thing that described a thing called gender dysphoria. You know, so I've got an hour to kill, and I'm going, oh, what's this? Gender what? And it's just a little piece, and it just says, okay, so, you know, some people are born with basically a brain gender that's different to the body gender, and there's no cure for it except to make the body fit the mind. That's the only cure that works. And then it went through and laid out how that was done, and it told people stories who had done this. And by the time Mike got out of her operation, I was just beside myself. I can't even tell you. I mean, it was like some strange drug took over, and I couldn't think about anything else. And I couldn't think about anything else for weeks. It's like, my God, it was unfucking believable. This is a thing, and this describes my situation precisely, and there's a fix for the damn thing. They can fix it. It was absolutely insane.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome, because you go to where women are to find out about how to become a woman.
Yeah.
It's the most amazing thing.
Like, what a relief it is learning, like, oh my God, there's like a thing. There's like a set solution to this problem, like, that exists. Like, what it must be like learning that for the first time. It's amazing. Although I imagine probably was not able to offer as much emotional support to her friend who just had an abortion as she would have otherwise been able to do.
Girl, how you feeling? Never mind. You should see what I just read.
Look at this thing.
Right. Like, I'm staying. You can go home.
Yeah. Yeah, you had to be really fucking proactive back then to learn anything about what it meant to be transgender. In fact, Corrine got her first real education in that from a porn shop in San Diego, which is, I think, where a lot of us learn a lot of things. But here's her story.
There were magazine bookstores, some people X-rated. And I walked into a store one day, and of course there were some magazines of transsexuals, blah, 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 done in a porn-type setting. But there was an article in one of them showing pictures of somebody that had completed gender reassignment surgery, and flipped through that a couple of times and something clicked. You know, I looked in the mirror and I'm like, no way. But that lit the fuse. By the time I got out of the service, I was at that point seriously fighting my dysphoria, figuring I could win the battle still.
But to really understand what was going on with her, Corrine had to, well, go to New York and hire a prostitute.
When you're from the New York City area, there are places where you can go to meet people like that. Unfortunately, a lot of those girls are what we would term working girls. And there was a place where they would go work. And one night, in my off time, I found myself down there and opened my car door. And an individual with the street name of Cookie got into my car. And I told this person point blank, I said, I'm going to pay you, and all I want is information. I asked some questions. Cookie gave me some answers. And I said, if I needed to find out more, because I have a feeling I'm more like you than not, where would I go? Who would I talk to?
And at that point, Cookie took her to a gay and transgender bar in New York, which is where she learned pretty much everything else.
Nothing better than the day you find your people.
Yeah.
It's the greatest thing.
It's amazing that, like, there's only so much you can do before you find your people.
Yeah.
Like, that's the key, like, ingredient, I think, in particularly anyone in this situation. Like, you can read the books and you can read the magazines, but eventually you just have to, like, find another group of people who are going to the same thing and ask them, like, what the hell are you doing? How do you deal with this? It's fascinating to me that, like, before the internet existed, your best bet for good information on what it means to meant to be trans, what it meant to transition, was maybe just finding a prostitute.
Or looking for somebody incredibly effeminate,
yeah,
at the local library in a porn type setting, which is going to be the phrase for the week.
Yeah, in a porn type setting.
Serving hot wings in a porn type setting. Please get these flowers from this flower shop in a porn type setting.
And I think it's interesting that two of our three sources really started dealing with this in a big way when they were in the military. Of course, Corrine was in San Diego because, mm-hmm, she was in the military and obviously couldn't, you know, when she first read that magazine, couldn't do anything about it. It was just, like you said, lit the fuse. It wasn't until she was out and walking around New York that she was able to, like, find the right prostitute.
Right.
Yeah, which is what we're all looking for.
Especially in New York.
We all need a cookie to help us understand what's going on with us. It is interesting, sort of the illegal nature of it, because one thing I got from talking to Allison is that the whole process of transitioning back then was more like buying LSD off the street than getting a medical procedure.
So in this pamphlet, you know, they had a couple of names of organizations that, you know, you could contact. Anyway, it just turned into this sort of daisy chain of telephone calls, and eventually put me in touch with an organization in Europe, and they put me in touch with someone in the city I was in, and I got them, and, you know, they didn't return my call, and I left a message on an answer machine, and eventually I got a call back, and they said, well, go to this place Tuesday night at 8 o'clock.
I mean, it sounds a lot like a drug deal, to be honest.
It was rather strange. The place was in sort of a sketchy part of town, you know, and you went in, and the door was locked, and you knock on the door, and somebody pokes their head out and takes a real good look at you and says, yeah, what do you want? And you sort of say who you are, and they say, okay, come in. And then when you get in there, there's like half a dozen women sitting with paper cups of bad coffee, and they start, you know, talking, and I'm sitting quietly, and I'm like, who the fuck are these people and what is going on here? And you just sort of sit it out, and eventually you get enough nerve to speak up and say your thing. And I went to a couple of those, and then they said, okay, well, here's the doctor you talk to. And I made an appointment.
See, like a mix between buying acid and an AA meeting.
Yeah, a trans underground where you have to say it, you know, and act a certain way to get in the door in the first place.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Well, it's still most, the majority of hate crime murders in the United States are transgender women. And there's not that many of them. If you compare them to every other race group, whatever, that gets hate crime murdered, like, they're by far the smallest, but they make up the largest actual number of murders. And that's 2017. So obviously, like, you got to keep a lid on that shit.
Yeah.
Like, if it's, yeah, 1988, like, you're not going to be, I mean, Reagan's in the White House. That was danger zone.
And it's probably why we don't have a face to associate with that movement. There's nobody who is taking credit for being the first. There's not a lot of pioneers that come out and say, I was one of the first. Because if it was me and I had to go through all that, half the shit that you bought would be Brandon Johnson transgender.
Yeah.
I'd want full licensing rights.
You'd be branding that shit.
I'd be branding it if I had to go through it in the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah, no, yeah. That makes complete sense.
We all want credit for cuffing our pants first.
Yeah, there we go.
But then you get a situation here where they're not even asking for credit. They're just trying to be pioneers. That is incredible because it's selfless.
You do have really well-cuffed pants.
I mean, you know.
I feel like our listeners should know that.
I started it.
So, Allison, had her information, had found her group of people, which was a little bit less fun than Corrine's because they weren't drinking anything but bad coffee. And so she decided to transition. And one of the things that makes her story really interesting is that she was one of the very first people in really any part of the world to transition openly at work. She had a high-powered job in the technology industry and felt like she was fairly indispensable to her team. So she could say, like, I'm going to do this thing. And had a chance of getting away with it. But she still had to scheme to get away with it. Like, here's sort of how she went about making sure that she wouldn't get fired during this whole process.
I was a sort of lead engineer on this team that was implementing new technology. And this is like 1988, 89. There were about 4,000 employees. And this coincided with my beginning transition. So, you know, here I am. On hormones, change is starting to happen, you know, it's going to become visible pretty soon, any day now, right? You know, living as a woman on my own time, putting on the man suit to go to work. And yeah, I had very long hair at the time, but I sort of got away with that because if you were a computer engineer at that time, you got a big pass on eccentric behavior. Hiding in the rock and roll scene at night and hiding in the computer geek scene during the day, you know, and getting a pass on both accounts. God, I was so stealth. So we sort of strategized. There had been a woman in another part of the country who had managed this. That was also in a high-tech company. She had also been an engineer, and she had managed to pull off an at-work transition, which just hadn't been done before. And we thought we might try this for me, too, because I couldn't really afford to lose the job because, not to put too fine a point on it, transition is bloody expensive. So I sweated over this email working with my therapist, and we sort of crafted this one-page email saying, okay, this is the deal, this is what's happening. This is why I look a little odd, and I'm going to look a whole lot odder in a few weeks. And this is the situation, you know. Actually, I'm a woman, and I'm going to be living as a woman, so you can expect to be seeing that. And we sent this email out to, I think I might have sent it out to maybe six, eight, ten people that I knew on my team and sort of who I had confidence in, knowing damn well that this was just going to, you know, absolutely surge through the company, right? But the idea was quite specifically to do an end run on upper management, because they would have discharged me in a heartbeat, even at the cost of their own program. Because, yeah, upper management sort of these, the old boys, right? I mean, there weren't even any women managers in this day. I mean, they were all white guys. And yeah, we did an end run on them. By the time I got called into HR, it was too late.
And you knew you had to do an end run around them. Like, that was, there was never any question in your mind.
Oh, it was entirely strategic. If I'd done what they wanted me to do, what after the fact they said they would have liked me to do, which is just quietly go into HR and have them manage things, oh, I would have been out the door. There was no doubt about it. I would have been absolutely out the door and jobless. So you want to hear how it went down after that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, okay, so like the next day, yeah, there's a cafeteria. I mean, so it's 4,000 employees, right? So, you know, any one time, there's probably 1,000 people in there at lunchtime, and I go in to get my lunch, and I walk out to where the kiosk is, where the cashier is, and looking out into the main cafeteria, and the whole place drops completely silent. And 1,000 heads turn. Holy shit. I just kind of packed my food and went back to my desk. But it was so, and it was like that for weeks. It was like that dream you have where you show up in class and discover you forgot to put trousers on. It was like that dream, day after day after day after day. And then even after I transitioned at work and I was dressing as a woman and completely passable by that time, going on a couple of months, right? Because I was very lucky in terms of my appearance, and I was passable very quickly. And even so, it's like any time you go anywhere, eyes are taking you apart. What she's wearing, how she's behaving, what she looks like, how she fucking walks, I would hear about.
My favorite part is the chuckling, the way that after all this, she came out and she still laughs. And the big laughs always come from her presenting herself. So she's like, yeah, this one time this person had to know about me and this is what happened. And there's a little bit of regret in some of it, but there's so much joy and like, that's what happened. This person was like this on it. I love that.
Yeah, and I love the Ocean's 11 like heist nature of planning this thing out. Like, I know that if I go to HR, they're going to fire me right away. But if I start by talking to like my engineering coworkers who are like weird nerds in the 80s and a little bit more open-minded and remind them like, you can't do this job without me, maybe I won't get fired.
Right. It's the greatest thing about a society is like whenever we need something, we suddenly become super accommodating. Oh, we're trying to solve this problem, so we don't care what you are. Just help us solve this problem. Try that every day, everybody.
The other thing that she points out that was really interesting to me was like putting on a man suit to go to work. She describes herself as looking like David Bowie in this time period. And I don't know if that's, I mean, to me, that's like a best case scenario. Like, who doesn't want to look like David Bowie in the 1980s? Yeah.
And you're doing your makeup in a way that is already pretty extreme. If you remember the makeup from the 80s, it was pretty extreme, male or female. So it was probably easier at that time period. Whereas in the years where it's like, it's just a subtle shade of blush, it's not so easy.
It sounds like a John Hughes movie, that scene where she goes into her cafeteria at work and everybody, because it's like, she's like a chupacabra at that point, like this mythical creature. No one's ever heard of that. Also incredibly awkward.
But like, again, she always walks in with this mentality of like, ha ha, deal with it.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah. That's got to be so tough. Because I think like, I don't know, I always avoid any situation where I'm going to have to like stand in the middle of a bunch of people and know that everybody's staring at me. Like, nobody wants that. Like, if you want that, if that's the kind of thing you want to do, then you become an actor.
Right.
And you still, like, you do it in a situation where you have control. Nobody enjoys being gawked at.
Right. Yeah. Unless you have that pioneer DNA.
Yeah.
Which sounds like what we're dealing with is somebody who's like, I get it. Yeah. I get it that I'm about to be alone, but I also get it that I'm not going to back down.
Yeah.
That's dope.
And I do think it's important to point out that not, even in like the 70s and 80s, not everybody's transitioning experience was so fraught and something that you had to like fight so hard for. Kareen transitioned in New York City in the 70s and enjoyed a shockingly preposterous amount of support.
In comes the owner of a pretty good real estate agency in Forest Hills. And when I met, the first time I met him, I was dressed. He was like, where did you get those legs from? I said, I was born with these legs. And he knew what I was going through, and I said, and then he saw me dressed in boy mode, and he said, you're really nice. I'll bet you could sell real estate. I said, I could sell anything if I have the product knowledge. He said, well, let's talk. He wound up sending me to school for my real estate agent's license, and I hung it with him. I learned the ropes from him and turned out to be one of his best real estate agents, and then the money started coming in. We had an argument one day, and had nothing to do with me, and it was a silly argument. And by that time, I had some idea of my self-worth in business, and I'm like, I said, I'm out of here. And I walked out. I didn't make it four blocks before another real estate agency heard I was available, and then I met another amazing person, the owner of that real estate agency. He goes, you are aware that everybody in the real estate world in this part of New York knows who and what you are? At the same time, I had the money to really plow ahead with the electrolysis and start to make some real plans. This person that I had met, the owner of the second real estate agency, we shook hands on a deal. He took 15% of every dime that I made and put it in the safe and would not release it to me for any other reason other than gender reassignment surgery, so that no matter what, I could not spend that money for any other reason. And he made good on his word. His mother worked at the agency. She loved me. The other agents were people that I had known in the area that knew me, and they watched me undergo this transition. I mean, I was kind of starting at night when I had met them, but they watched me come in, you know, some days with my face swollen from electrolysis. And finally, one day, we did a total building closing. Everybody that had bought units came in. We did this mass closing on this co-op. And I was kind of dressed in boy mode, but, you know, my face at that point was hair-free. The lines on my face had softened, and people genuinely didn't know what to call me, no matter what I was wearing. And the owner of the agency, Ben, pulls me aside and says, listen, we've been out with you. We know what you look like when you're not here. He said, I think you're ready. He goes, I know you have a Jones New York business wardrobe in your closet, warmed up and ready to go. What do you say on Sunday you come into work dressed more appropriately for work?
Yeah.
Because hate is the bologna sandwich, right? And that's what we're forced to eat down here, poor people. They serve the bologna sandwich. But what rich people know is that acceptance is steak. And when they need to eat steak, when they want to get down on the real meal, they are accepting. And it's incredible because the rest of us, we got sold this bill of, be prejudiced, sort of don't get along. But everybody at the tippy top who's making money actually helps people be different because difference is lucrative.
That was like the path to any kind of acceptance for both Allison and Corrine was like through their professional competence. Like that's the bridge that you've got. Now, I think you see the same thing. Like the civil rights movement was really like incubated to a large extent by the military being both draft based and like suddenly it was integrated. So suddenly you've got all of these like white kids from Alabama who've never seen a black guy like with one in their unit and they're fighting together and they have to rely on each other. That's how societally it works. But even in like a one-on-one sort of situation, you've got this place, you know, New York City in the 1970s, which is probably a good place to be transgender compared to the rest of the country, but not a great time to be an openly transgender person. But because you're good at your job, that's the Trojan horse to acceptance, is making money for people.
Yeah.
Which I guess is one of the upshots of capitalism. As long as you can make money, you can get acceptance.
It does give you anonymity if you are profitable. In these stories, we keep hearing that over and over again, is that because I was profitable, I was allowed freedom.
Yeah, which is like fucked up in like an absolute sense. Like, oh, that shouldn't be the only thing that allows you to live your life is the way you actually are. But at the same time, like, at least they had an option.
Yeah, there's a part of it that's, like you said, it's awful. And there's a part of it that's like, well, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
You should be profitable and not judged for anything other than how good you do your job.
Yeah, and it's kind of like if we're going to be capitalists, we should at least be consistent about that.
Right.
Yeah, and not give a shit about anything but someone's ability to make money.
Right.
Yeah, so I guess that's where it's an upside. I should probably point out here that all of our sources today are technically the lucky ones, because back when they transitioned, the process was only open to people who were already pretty capable of looking like a cisgender woman. And Allison's going to tell us a little bit about that now.
In the 1980s, if you're a trans woman, you walk into the office, you better look like a woman. You better look like whatever his idea of a woman is. And so there is a lot of pressure to anticipate and figure out what the expectation is, because from your point of view, this is a life and death situation. You have to have that treatment at whatever cost it comes at. And part of that cost is you need to present as a convincing heteronormative woman. Because if you don't, they're going to send you packing, aren't they? So that's what we call passing. Passing as cisgender. It sort of sounds like you're passing yourself off as something you aren't, but it's really quite the opposite.
Doctors generally required their patients live as their new gender for 6 months, even a year before transitioning. And here's Jackie to talk about that.
The time scale that we're talking about was probably about 6-7 months, because then I started my real life experience, as they called it back then, which is when you have to obviously live in role for a period of time. So about 6 months, 7 months after I left the RAF is when I started. And then obviously ultimately my transition and surgery about a year and a half after I started my life experience. That was so, so difficult in that sort of aspect, where they made you feel guilty rather than actually try to understand the actual problem itself and try to understand why you felt this way. But I like to think that I have been fairly blessed with the way I look, blessed with the way I blend in. I've been successful in being able to do modeling and things like that, so that in that case they saw that I was being able to function as a normal female would function in the wider world. But they still wanted to make sure that I was 100% certain this is what I wanted to do and why I wanted to do it.
All men should have to live as a woman for 6 months.
Yeah.
Just to get what they go through.
Yeah, it should be like in Israel, you got to join the army for a year. We should have to, everyone should swap genders for a year. Because I think women should have to, there should be some prosthesis to where they have to learn what it's like to zip up a zipper too. Like that's the only key part of the male experience, but it's important.
Yeah.
We struggle too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Barely, but we do struggle. But
barely.
We don't have to put on a bra every morning, but jeez. No.
But man, sometimes you're drunk, zipping your pants, it's a disaster. Yeah. I think one of the other things that was really interesting to me talking to these women was learning that, like, it's not just a matter of presenting as a woman so you can, like, prove you're serious, which makes a certain degree of sense. It's like, before you go through all this stuff, you should have to show them that you're, you know, you're not, this isn't, like, a passing thing for you. But you have to actually, like, convince a battery of doctors that you really want it. Like, you have to argue your case. Like, it's not just you go in for any other medical procedure. It's like, my fucking arm hurts. Like, right. I need the no more arm hurt surgery. Like, Allison had to go in front of a battery of doctors and argue her case. And here's her talking about that.
There were three psychotherapists who would work with trans people in the city I was in. And I kind of called all three of them. And then, you know, one of them called me back and said she had an opening. So I went in and I saw her. And, you know, I wasn't in my sort of day job clothes, but, you know, I sort of went in. I didn't know how to dress, so I kind of went in halfway, but, you know, basically the way I tended to look off hours, you know. And I walk in, and bear in mind that I'm completely new at this. I don't know any of the language, you know. At this point, I only like half believe it anyway, right? And I walk in, and she sits me down. And, you know, sort of says, okay, you know, what's your thing, you know, sort of like therapists do, you know. And then about, like, 15 minutes in, she says, okay, so how long have you been transitioning? And I said, well, that's what I'm here for. I haven't. And she, her eyebrows go up. She goes, oh, really? Because she's looking at me in the way I look. So, and then, you know, at the end of that first session, you know, because I don't know how this goes. I'm supposed to get a diagnosis or something, right? So I said, you know, when do you make your diagnosis? And she said, oh, God, I did that 10 minutes in. She says, there's no question about you. So, you know, the sort of the standards of care at that time. So yeah, I think we did two sessions, and then she gave me the referral to the endo. And within a week after that, I was on estrogen.
I mean, I would have to think that in that time, as obscure as gender dysphoria, being transgender, was at that sort of time in the medical community, and as I have a lot of respect for the doctors who would make that a priority, because it can't have been an easy field for their career.
The doctors that practiced in this area tended to keep a very low profile, you know. To be honest, I mean, I guess I have to assume that their motivation was largely humanitarian, because these are people, I mean, like, for example, my endo, his practice was primarily diabetics. I mean, that was his business. And this was like a little thing he did on the side. You could only get an appointment in the afternoon on, I forget, it was like Thursdays or something, you know. And at that time, the office was closed to regular patients. And the trans patients could come in and sort of be completely separate from the rest of the practice, because he couldn't have that being seen, because it would have been a career killer for him. So it was like that. And it was the same with the psychotherapists. There would be certain days that would take trans clients. Trans clients were definitely not to show up at other times.
I guess that partly makes some sense why the doctors are so cagey with their patients, because they're putting their careers at risk. But also, like, imagine that, like, knowing that your doctor would pretend not to know you if you came at the wrong time.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very much underground, and even, like, the process of getting treatment would be very underground. Corrine had to deal with, you know, black market hormones.
Endocrinologists back then, they really didn't, they had no clue what they were looking at, as people were coming to them saying, help me. Psychologists and psychiatrists at that point, you know, they understood dysphoria. At the time, it was classified as an illness while the people were protesting. At the time, they didn't understand this was as much a physical malady as anything emotional. This, in my mind, this was like being born with a congenital birth defect that you could try and seek some relief from. It was a good, healthy way for me to look at it, and so that I wouldn't get emotionally destroyed. I was born with a different mind, but it presented more as a birth defect than anything else. It actually helped me at the time to look at it like that. Did I understand that there were physical as well as psychological reasons for it? Of course not. They were only beginning to suspect things like that. Harry Benjamin was only beginning to look under the hood of the car at that point, trying to figure out what the hell was going on.
Harry Benjamin was one of the first doctors in the United States to actually, like, work with transgender people, and the Harry Benjamin Society, which was a charity he established, kind of started the standards of care for, like, this is how you transition and whatnot. And we're going to talk a little bit about sort of the German scientists that he studied under initially, but, like, that was, you know, at this point he was the only name, the only medical professional who was, like, sort of out and open, is like, I deal with this community of people and I'm going to, like, make them my priority. Everybody else was hiding.
That is the sketchiest thing I've ever heard. Black market hormones sounds like free children's toys.
Yeah.
It's like something that you would kind of avoid.
Yeah, like, it's one of those things, like, if I buy some LSD or something, like, I know there's, like, one of seven or eight chemicals it could be if it feels like LSD, because right. There's a whole bunch, like, you don't know, you're getting a fucking eyedropper full of something, like, or a little cartoon thing.
Yeah.
But, like, I know, I'm just trying to get high, like,
yeah.
Fucking hormones, like, who knows what you're shooting into yourself if it's on the black market.
And suddenly your voice is a lot deeper instead of a lot higher.
Yeah.
And you have boobs, but these boobs, one of them, much, much larger.
But I guess the fact that that didn't happen to her means that there were at least a lot of black market hormone dealers who, I don't know, cared as much about providing people with quality hormones as, you know, the odd good acid connection that you get.
Yeah, unlike most dealers, I don't cut my black market hormones with water or orange juice.
Or chicken hormones.
Right.
Yeah.
This is human estrogen. It's not part cow.
I can only imagine that being sold by somebody with, like, a bunch of needles and a trench coat. I'm almost certain that's not how it went, but...
This guy's got everything. He's got cocaine, methamphetamine, estrogen.
Got that testosterone, right. Vitamin T if you're really looking to go.
You need to try some of this E. Oh, ecstasy? Nah, dog, estrogen. Same trip. But then afterwards you wake up and you're gorgeous.
Yeah, so as I kind of talked about earlier, transitioning ended at this period in time with what Allison referred to as you would woodwork yourself. You would hide. The goal wasn't to live as a transgender person. The goal was to get the sex change, gender change, reassignment surgery, so that you never had to acknowledge the earlier part of your life had happened again. And this is kind of, she really left everything behind.
I got a new job in another city. I was fortunately with things as they were then, you know, with new documentation. And I was lucky because to get that job, I had to put my CV together, right? And I just put my same CV with my references and my education, work history, and put my new proper name on there and just sort of hoped and prayed and sent it off. And I just, once again, how many times have I been lucky? I was lucky again. They didn't check my references. And I got the job, and I sold my house, and I moved, and I never looked back. You know, there were a couple of friends I sort of tried to stay in touch with a little bit, but it just didn't work. I couldn't do it. I needed to disappear, and I did so.
Like Al Pacino in Heat.
Yeah, because once you can change your gender, you can also change your entire life.
Yeah. And this is pre-internet, so, you know, there's nobody's got lingering Facebook photos to delete. Like, you're not crawling around for your old MySpace. You don't have to hop onto the Wayback Machine and see what's left. Like, you can really make a clean break.
Yeah, now if you were ever goth in your life, it's going to haunt you.
Yeah, every bad pair of pants I've ever owned is immortalized on the internet. So I guess that's one way in which it was easier back then.
Yeah.
But I think it's also important to note that getting woodworked like she did, it wasn't like a matter of being ashamed. It was like a practical defense measure. Like if someone were to find out about your past, it could absolutely ruin your career. And that actually happened to Jackie. After she transitioned, she started and became a very successful and prominent model. And then she was outed by the paparazzi and lost her modeling career.
I suppose once I obviously got to that point where I'd obviously gone through the transitional process and I thought, hey, I've now made it. I've got to the promised land, for better tone of a phrase. And then being able to get to the point where, yes, I've hit that point. I've hit the truth of where I need to be, being able to be recognized, being able to be a successful model. And then all of a sudden, the best way I can describe this is a bit like the Notting Hill moment where the character goes to the door, sees the press, tries to close the door, and then, of course, Julia Roberts then walks in as a barrage of flashbulbs. That's what it was like for me, is opening a door and seeing that barrage of flashbulbs, and then you open the paper and you see these horrible sort of headlines saying, it's a man. And you're suddenly then faced with the actual model agencies are then turning around and say, we no longer want this person because Jackie is not a real woman in that perspective.
Was the fallout kind of confined to your career and personal life, or did you feel at any point sort of like physically
threatened or concerned that there was going to be some sort of violence visited upon you? Because I know that's not an uncommon worry for transgender people the world over. I don't know about the UK.
Well, certainly back in that sort of time, I mean, we are talking about the late 80s, early 90s. So definitely without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, when that headline appeared in the paper, everywhere I went, again, I was living in the city of Aberdeen, which you would think would be a very cosmopolitan city. It's the oil capital of Europe, is what we're told. And everywhere I went in that city, it was a case of the finger was being pointed at me. So I felt, yes, I felt threatened. I felt that I was being judged. I felt that I couldn't move forward. And I just did hit quite a bit of a low point in my life, I have to admit, because I just couldn't be my authentic self, my true self again, because they've taken that privilege away from me.
Which is crazy, because if you have a product that you're trying to sell and it looks good on everybody, you should actually make the claim that if it was makeup, it looks good even on someone who may not have been born as a woman. It brings out the woman in everyone, not just women.
You'd think there could be an angle for that.
Yeah.
It's also just so, I guess paparazzi's always been pretty fucked up, but just the idea that like as soon as this person gets outed, like there's this storm to get a picture of them in their front porch, like looking like frazzled in the morning before they've put on makeup or gotten dressed. Like nobody looks good if you ambush them walking out of their door at like 8:30 in the morning to grab a newspaper.
And who cares? Who cares? Yeah. If you can't tell, then it doesn't matter. If somebody's put that much effort into their life and their lifestyle that you can't tell where they originate from, then why would you care about the first day? Let's care more about today. Can this person sell Maybelline?
To an extent, it's still like that, even with like Caitlyn Jenner, who's like enjoyed a lot of acceptance in public for, you know, transitioning. Like as soon as she wrote in her autobiography that she'd had the genital part of the surgery, like suddenly there's like 50,000 fucking stories about what she had done to her genitals. Like there's still that like voyeuristic attitude of like, we have to talk about every aspect of this person's life. Like you don't have a privacy because what you're doing is weird to us. So you don't deserve to be able to enjoy the same kind of privacy anybody else has.
Right.
Like there's no other celebrity who it is appropriate for us to talk about. You don't even get a lot of stories about like myths about which male celebrities have big dicks, because that's like inappropriate.
Right.
But with Caitlyn Jenner, that's front page news.
Right, whether there is one or not.
Yeah, yeah. That's wild. I don't know. It's a really shitty catch-22 for a lot of trans people, because there are such huge consequences for being outed. But there's also a lot of life situations where you're expected to out yourself, like dating, even though that can be incredibly dangerous to tell somebody that you've just met, you know, what's happened, especially when they're flirting with you and whatnot. Well, Corrine, after transitioning, spent a chunk of her life giving lectures on transgender life to classrooms full of high schoolers. And this is in like, you know, the late 80s, early 90s. And she's noticed that the question of secrecy is the one thing, like that's the thing that everybody always asks about, whether or not she tells people that she's going on dates about her past.
And I learned very early on, I'd come in with an envelope and I'd hand it to one of the professors. And I said, "Can you hold this envelope? I'll tell you when to open it." And when I would come to the first guy and I would call on the one that looked like they were afraid of me, and I said, "Do you have a question, please?" And the first question, without fail, was, "If you were dating a guy, would you tell them before you went to bed with them?" And I would turn to the professor and I'd say, "Please open that envelope and read what I have written." Professor would open the envelope, open the paper, look up with a smile and say, "If you were going to go to bed with a guy, would you tell him before you went to sleep with him?" And I looked at the kid and I said, "That is the first question that every guy in this class asks me."
Yeah, and think of how scary that is, because there's an actual legal defense called the trans panic or gay panic defense that's been used successfully in murder cases. In 2004, a trans woman named Gwen Arujo was murdered when three boys she'd had intimate relations with started to suspect she was trans. I'm going to quote from the Wikipedia article here. Gwen was subjected to forced genital exposure in the bathroom, after which it was announced that, quote, he was really a man. The defendants claimed that Arujo's failure to disclose her biological sex was tantamount to deception, and that the subsequent revelation of her biological sex, quote, had provoked the violent exposure to what Thorman represented as a sexual violation so deep it's almost primal. Thorman was the boys' lawyer. The first trial resulted in a jury deadlock, and the second, the defendants Mike Magidson and Jose Merrell were convicted of second-degree murder, while the jury again deadlocked in the case of Jason Cazares. Cazares later entered a plea of no contest to charges of voluntary manslaughter. The jury failed to return the requested hate crime additions to the convictions for the defendants. If you kill someone who tells you that they're trans on a date, you have odds of either getting away or at least getting your sentence reduced. And yet still there's this expectation where you would tell me, right?
Like, right, but men lie about so much more important shit to women all the time. Like, this is my BMW and that is my house.
Yeah. Well,
who cares about gender reassignment when you lie to me about everything you've ever accomplished?
Yeah, and how is it not a lie to, like you invite someone back to your house for the first time. Like, there's no way you don't spend hours cleaning that place, getting up, lighting incense. Like, that's way more of a lie.
Also, I want to make love to you all night is a lie.
Yeah.
No, you don't, and it's never happened.
That's what dating is yeah. Like, is lying to each other about the things that you're most scared about until you can get comfortable enough to be honest with someone. Like, it's weird that there's that double standard for transgender people, but like, nobody expects men to be honest about how we keep our kitchens when we live alone.
Right. And your rights end where your dick starts. So you make a decision as to where you want to put that. Then you don't necessarily get an after effect where you get to say, oh, if I'd have known, I wouldn't have done that. That's not how that works. That works that once you become intimate with a person, that is solely your choice. It's not their responsibility to let you know more information so that you can make a different decision. It's your responsibility to keep it in your pants until you know the whole story.
You know, kind of changing gears a little bit, when we were first talking about this, and I think earlier in this same session, you talked about what it's like going from being like the top of the world for the last, I don't know, what, 500 years or so has been like white dude.
That's the golden ticket.
That's the golden ticket. And, you know, transitioning to a woman now is still kind of a step down in terms of your actual like rights and your how easy it is to get jobs and how easy it is to get work. Corrine started transitioning in 1979, which is not only a worse time for trans rights, it was just a worse time for women's rights in general.
And a garbage time for jeans.
Oof, great time for jackets, though.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's hear her talk about that a little bit.
However, my mother's reaction was quite modern. She, of course, objected strenuously, but her very first question was, why on earth would you want to be a second-class citizen when you can be the other thing? You know, it showed tremendous understanding of the world around her, yet no understanding of me in particular. And my mother and I, we were kind of oil and water for a long time, only child. God knows what she wanted from me. I'm pretty sure she wanted to be able to brag about her son, and I took that away from her. There was no way she was going to brag about that to her friends in that day and age.
What was actually interesting to me is that Corrine noted some really significant advantages to having grown up as a man and understanding the male perspective and then moving over to living life as a woman.
I had actually some very keen advantages. I understood what male competitiveness was.
And she also had the experience of her past life as a male cop in New York City, which had been her job immediately before transitioning. And that she carried with her even after transitioning.
One day, a guy walked in. He was not very well balanced. And he wound up sitting at my desk. And he had nothing to do with me. He was unbalanced. He was just being rude and, you know, trying to force something to happen in the business. I brought Mark with me. All right, I didn't leave Mark behind. I'm a whole person, and a whole person is made up of everybody that you've ever been and everything that you've ever thought. That includes your competitive edge. That includes your soft side. That includes your defensive capability. I don't mean physically defensive, but, you know, your ability to not shrink from a fight when you absolutely must. I got up from my desk, and I started backing this guy up towards the door. To that day, I still didn't realize how pretty and how feminine I had become. And I'm like, you're trespassing, you'll have to leave. And I started backing him up towards the door and out the door. And I figured, oh, well, you know, I guess I still got it. And I turned around, and every man in that office was standing right behind me, less than 6 inches behind me, ready to tackle this guy if I had a problem. I looked at them. I said, I scared them away. They were like, no, you don't scare anybody anymore.
So yeah, there's clearly a potential of danger there too.
Yeah, because you forget that you are not full testosterone, that you're part estrogen now, but you still have the mentality, which kind of makes me wonder if there is a push for activism Because once you transition into being a female and you have the rights and have had the life of a man, do you suddenly become a force for women?
Goddamn, you're such a natural.
What?
At podcasting, sir. Because the exact next thing I have on this script here is talking about activism. Jackie is the only one of our sources who's devoted a lot of time to transgender activism. Since being outed by the paparazzi, it's kind of something she felt like she had to do.
I've said this a couple of times recently. Being a role model is not something anyone goes out to be. I think it's just about allowing that aspect of whoever identifies under the wider umbrella, whether they be the younger generation or whether they be the older generation, because we know there are still people of an older generation who can't be them true selves for one reason or another, health conditions or because their parents are still alive. It's giving them that understanding that I've been able to make a success in my life by stepping on the platform at a very young age, but I keep on seeing it that I don't care what age you are. If you want to really, really be yourself, and that's what I say with my role modeling aspect, I want people to be themselves, whoever they are, however they identify, and wherever they are in the process. I don't care what job they do. I don't care how much money they earn or don't earn. I just want people to be themselves.
So yeah, that's Jackie, but she's the only one of our sources who's taken that attitude, who's like sort of throwing her weight into the fight. You know, both Allison and Corrine were very bold in their own lives, but they also both were content to live those lives without pushing into activism. I mean, Corrine did go and lecture and talk to students, which is, yeah, I mean, that's certainly a type of activism. But there wasn't like a political angle to that fight until pretty recently. And actually, they all kind of expressed pretty mixed opinions about how political it's gotten right now, because it's made, you know, increased trans visibility has been good for a lot of people. Like, we're not gonna argue against that. But it's also had far from universal outcomes. Corrine expressed being pretty scared of it.
There was no internet. There was no way I had of knowing how many of us there actually were. Even in New York, where there are plenty, I was still in my own little world. And only now, you know, in the last 5 years, since I reached out for the community to see what was there, have I discovered there are other pilots, there are doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, and I'm so not alone here. I thought I was really hot shit. I met people that could put me in their pocket and walk away. I was absolutely astonished at the variety of people.
Which sounds really positive, but at the same time, Corrine grew up with a father who was a Holocaust survivor, so she grew up with a very bright, shining example in her life of the dangers of being a member of a very visible, very scapegoated minority group. And so as exciting as it's been for her to like connect with sort of the upswing of, in trans activism lately, there's also an aspect of it that terrifies her.
I went to the Philadelphia Health Conference a couple of years ago. I had no idea that kids were coming out so young and how many there were. And it makes sense because now there is a vocabulary to put to what they were feeling. The information is out there for them to discover when they start trying to figure out what the hell is going on with me. I don't know that there are any more transgender people now than there were back then, except they're not waiting anymore. They're not waiting for the damage that gets done hormonally over the years before they can reach out with any luck and stop it. I had no idea. Who would know, A, that gay people would get the latitude to get married, even though we're getting pushback on it now? Who would know that there would be that much visibility on the transgender side? But the minute I saw it happening, I'm like, this is going to backfire in a very bad way. The world is not really ready to see how many of us there are. And unfortunately, I appear to be correct. I worry. I worry for my friends. And I'm thinking, you know, woodwork is not a bad idea. I'm almost at the end of my journey. You know, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. I do not wish that light to turn into an oncoming train, okay? I've always been a very practical person. I've always had a good instinct for survival. And everything that I'm looking at tells me that we run a horrible, horrible risk here. You know, there is some fear. Again, to be a snotty asshole, the people that are screaming, you know, it's okay if I don't pass, I just want to live my life, blah, 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 I don't need this, I don't want that. And I'm thinking the only reason you're saying it is because you don't think you can pass. You're trying to find some way to have a normal life. I understand that. At the same time, it's like, but It's like trying to swim out to save a drowning person. They're going to drag you under with them. And I know that sounds cruel, but if my father has taught me anything, it's how to survive. He survived the war by being clever, by being tough when he needed to be. That's the only reason he walked out of that hell. So, in essence, I am my father's child.
It's the complexity of Christmas.
Yeah.
It's that Christmas is rooted in this concept that may or may not be concrete. I don't want to spoil it for anybody. And then at the same time, your parents are the people who kind of work for these gifts. Mm-hmm. They can't tell you these things because it would ruin your mystery and it would ruin the fascination with something so great. But at the same time, you'll have to know the truth so that you can provide Christmas later for somebody else. So it's an odd thing because these women are stuck wanting to be a champion for something, but having to keep it something that you find on your own and not be able to define it for you. It's the complexity of the longer you're in a movement, the more problems you're going to have. It's sophomore syndrome.
Yeah, I think it's some of that, and it's some of just like, I don't know, like you could call it privilege, just like this has worked out for me, and now it's more dangerous because like I have to worry about stuff like, what if I go to the bathroom and it's in a place where they've got some weird law against it or something? Like that wasn't a problem for most of these women's lives. Like they didn't have to deal with that fact.
It's like in the NBA when they buy a mansion and they don't know how to heat it. And you're just like, yeah, you lived in an apartment and it was fine. But now that you have a mansion, it's got 8 rooms. The next problem is somebody got to heat those rooms. Somebody's got to mow the back 40.
Yeah. And I don't think most of our listeners or most trans people would agree with Corrine's concerns. But I think they're also like important concerns to think about because there is like progress isn't a straight line, which we all got reminded of pretty recently. Like it's
this election.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it's, you can't trust that it's going to be a straight line forward, as messed up as it kind of sounds to say like, well, if you can't pass, like maybe you're putting the rest of us in danger. At the same time, like I get why she would be afraid of that. I get why she might see it as an oncoming train because there has been
luxury.
A blowback. And it is some luxury, but it's also like her fears aren't misplaced. Right. Other people in history have died thinking that they were finally, you know, in a safe position. Allison has been on both sides of this very, very confusing debate conversation within the trans community. After 25 years of isolation, she ran across a song from coming out by that band, The Axis of Awesome. And that was sort of the first time she realized that there was like an active transgender community out there where people are actually being open about this stuff.
I'm like, holy shit, you know, she's doing this in public? Are you fucking kidding me? You know, because you bear in mind, I'm sort of back in 1990, right? I don't realize it's 2016. Then I start seeing other videos because I hadn't really looked at YouTube before then. And I'm like, God, there's hundreds of these things out there. Are you kidding? I could not believe it. And so I started poking around and started, you know, kind of got on Twitter, I think it was, and, you know, started talking to trans people. What a strange idea. And, you know, kind of got to know a couple people a little bit online, and they said, yeah, well, you know, there's going to be this trans pride thing. You should really come. And I said, you are fucking kidding. No, I don't think so. But they talked me into it, and I ended up going to this thing. And you've got to bear in mind, I mean, I've seen in my entire lifetime maybe a dozen trans people when I was transitioning, and no one in a quarter century. And I get drug out into this trans pride thing, and there's 1,000 goddamn trannies walking around. I could not believe it. I mean, it was just surreal. And I don't even know how to explain how bizarre that was. It's like, this is a thing. People are actually on public shit doing this and chanting and stuff. Oh, my God. I didn't even know what to make of it. And then one of the people that I was with said, you know, you should really, you know, write about this experience you're having because, you know, this is, you know, coming from where you come from back in the day, you know, you should really write about this. And I did. And I sort of put this story online and then wham, all of a sudden people responded to that. And I started writing. And here we are 8 months later. And I'm stepping up, much to my own surprise. I mean, you've got to remember, I mean, I was just hidden. And now, well, you mentioned Hirschfeld, and you were asking why people would take risks to help people like me. And now it's me taking it, what I see as a huge risk to help other people who need my help.
I want to stop there when she brings up Magnus Hirschfeld, because that really what we were talking about, progress not being a straight line. The first really prominent LGBTQ rights activist probably in the Western world was a guy named Magnus Hirschfeld. He was a German Jewish doctor and a sexologist who established the Institute of Sexual Research in Berlin. He and his institute performed basically the first mainstream research on gay and transgender people, actually trying to, like, well, what are you guys? What do you want? Like, what helps you? Like, what psychological problems do you have? What are the things that help with those problems? Like, and one of the first things the Nazis did after taking power in 1933 was destroy the Institute and burn its library. Up until that point, Berlin was kind of like a golden place in the world for trans people, for gay people. You could be gay in Weimar, Berlin. Mm-hmm. You could be trans and be safer than pretty much anywhere else. But that visibility was then counteracted by fucking Nazis. I'm sure you've seen this famous picture of a Nazi book burning. The guy's just in media res tossing it.
Yes.
Those are interviews with transgender people. That's the library at Hirschfeld's Institute being burned in that famous Nazi book burning picture. These are pretty much the first people they went out, some of the first people they went after in a really organized way. So when Corrine says that she sees an oncoming train, it's not like trans people, especially trans people who grew up in the 50s and who have a direct connection to the Holocaust, don't have a really worrying precedent as to what kind of consequences run with increased visibility.
Trans visibility has not been a great thing for a lot of us. People are getting hurt now, whereas before we were sort of invisible. We're not invisible anymore, and there are people who are out to figure out who we are and do us bad. And for some reason, I've decided I'm going to step up and write about this. And I've been writing for 8 months, and the response has been huge. And it's like now I almost feel like I don't have a choice any longer. I'm being told every single day that people need me to do this. And I guess I've decided to do it against my own better judgment. I'm doing it.
Progress not being in a straight line is interesting because she still uses the term tranny. And that in a 2017, that is considered a derogatory term.
Yeah.
But when you're talking to a pioneer who has earned the right to say what she wants about this movement, she can kind of say anything she wants without being corrected.
But she was very cognizant. Like in the first version of the interview we did, she used a lot of terms like good job and bad job, which was sort of used to refer to people who had surgeries that worked out and allowed them to pass and people whose surgeries didn't. That she really doesn't want us, and we're not using other than to comment on the specific thing, because she thinks they're very like offensive terms. And they are. Mm-hmm. Like that's a mean way to refer to a human being.
Right.
But that's also like, it's not when she uses those terms, when she uses the word tranny, she's not trying to be derogatory. She's using the word that was used her whole life for that sort of thing. Like it's, you can't just overwhelm that in a day, especially since, again, this is a woman who heard the word transgender first in 2016.
We see that in other movements as well for equality, fights for equality. People don't, again, have the language down necessarily, or the language changes so much you don't sound like an ally even though you are.
Yeah, and I think that might be like one way to help avoid so much of a blowback that people are afraid of here. It's important, like language matters, obviously. It's important to get better at the terms we use and to use terms that are, you know, more inclusive and less aggressive. But at the same time, like, you can't punish people for getting the words wrong, because then they're not going to listen to you about the meaning behind those words.
Right. That's why I call my parents slaves. To this day, I still call them slaves.
Wow.
Just so we can start the conversation.
That's a weird hill to die on.
Yeah.
How's that working out?
Not so good.
Cracked Gets Personal has been produced by Robert Evans, Brett Rader, and Alex Schmidt. It was engineered and edited by Brett Rader. Next week on Cracked Gets Personal, we'll ask some people from all over the world, what is it like to kill somebody?
You can talk about it all day long, but it's one of those experiences that once you're there and you do it, you realize it's not taking a human life, it's shooting a target.
For Robert Evans, I'm your host, Brandon Johnson. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. And again, I'd like to remind you to check out our sponsor, Comedy Bang Bang. It's a great show. Funniest people in the world. John Hamm, Andy Richter, Nathan Fielder, all recent guests. Anyone could stop by at any time. If you don't listen, you're missing the greatest thing that will ever happen to you. I don't care if you have kids, if you've participated in relief efforts and stared into the eyes of a rescued Somalian child and seen, you know, gratitude so deep that it cut you to the core of your soul. Whatever you're doing isn't as rewarding as Comedy Bang Bang. So listen to Comedy Bang Bang.
Hey everyone, Scott Aukerman here, and I am here to tell you why, if you love podcasts, and it sounds like you're listening to one right now, I bet that you're going to love a little show that I host on Earwolf called Comedy Bang Bang. Comedy Bang Bang is the show, there's no better way to describe it than as the show where I talk to interesting people. Doesn't that sound great? Some of those interesting people just this year that we've had on include Tig Notaro, Andy Samberg, Kumail Nanjiani, John Hamm, Rachel Bloom, so many more, and we have some amazing guests coming this fall that I can't even mention yet. And then stick around after my first interview because you never know what other entertaining people or interesting people just might show up. There has never been a better time to start listening to Comedy Bang Bang. Check it out on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.